Coming up on Broadway Videos, this week on Broadway, we talk about the movie Les Miserables. Mark Shenton from London joins us as well. We talk about what's happened over in 2012 on the West End, and he gives us a great view of things that we should see and things that might come to Broadway. So please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, December 30th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Mark Shenton. Mark is a London-based theater critic who writes regularly for The Stage, including reviews and from London and the regions, features, and since 2005, a daily online column. How do you do a daily online column? That's a lot of work, Mark.
It's a lot.
Well, it is. He also can be read at the Sunday Express, Playbill.com, and heard at TheaterVoice.com. So good morning, Mark. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Mark is joining us from his flat in Midtown Manhattan. So he's visiting us in between. We were in Barbados vacationing?
I was, just before Christmas. We now actually have an apartment here in Midtown because I come here so often. We decided to bite the bullet and jump in with both feet and buy some New York real estate. And it's great because it's just great to have a place you can call home in Midtown, where your near neighbor is Peter Felicia.
Also joining us from his flat in Midtown Manhattan is Peter Felicia. Peter is a writer who writes for Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays. He writes for Kritzerland on Fridays in the MTI blog throughout the month. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
All right. So Peter and Mark, and actually I also got a chance to see the film of Les Miserables, and it'd be interesting to talk about it since it seems as though that all the social media sites, Facebook and Twitter and everybody else, is writing about their perspective on the movie. So, Mark, why don't you introduce the movie for us and tell us what you thought?
Right. Well, of course, I've seen it numerous times in the theatre, as I'm sure has Peter. And it's really interesting that in opening it out to the cinema. In fact, one of the glories of Trevor Nunn and John Caird's original production is just how cinematic it feels. Now, Tom Hooper, adapting it for the cinema, has actually managed to achieve the paradoxical feat of making it feel incredibly stagey. It feels very set up and not terribly authentic, despite the fact that much of it was filmed on real sets, not CGI, but it all looks like CGI. And then the real sets that they built out at Pinewood Studios in near London, I actually went to visit, did a set visit in the summer, and they're incredibly detailed and brilliant sets, but it does feel like you're walking through a Las Vegas theme park hotel, like the Las Vegas Paris Hotel, for instance. It doesn't feel very real.
You know, I saw a video. They've been doing all sorts of behind the scenes promos for the movie, and they showed the building of the set in the sound studio that you just mentioned, and it was quite extensive. They took almost a month to build, so it's quite amazing. I'm going to put some notes, some links in the show notes to those videos, so that folks who are listening can easily find them. Mark, what did you think of the film overall?
Well, the
performances.
I thought there was some great things in it, and there was also some truly terrible things. I thought, for instance, on the Diffstaff side, I thought it was a great shame to see Russell Crowe massacring Javert, which is one of the great musical theatre roles. When you think of all the great people who've played that part over the years, from Roger Allen, who originated it in London, to Philip Quast, for instance, the Australian performer who did it at the 10th anniversary Royal Albert Hall concert. More recently, we had Hadley Fraser do it in the West End. Also, wonderful Norm Lewis came to London to do the O2 25th anniversary concert. We've had some great people do it. To see it not sung terribly well in the film, it seemed to me a casting opportunity missed. Hugh Jackman, on the other hand, is a triumph. He really can sing. He can really act. So he's a great asset to it. I think, funnily enough, for the original, for when I first saw it, I saw it at the Ziegfeld Cinema here in New York on Christmas Day, which was a great thing to do because, of course, you know, to see it with a packed house applauding every number is fantastic. But I saw it a few weeks before that in a preview screening room in London. And Peter Felicia, I'm sure you'll appreciate this, the historical detail. I took as my guest the original London Cosette, Rebecca Kennedy. And Rebecca sat next to me, weeping through the whole film.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It all meant so much to her. I mean,
sure. How could it not, right?
Yeah.
Oh, Peter, what did you think about the film?
I thought the film was nothing at all. It never to me was exciting or moving. It sat there to me. They began singing. They stopped singing. We all went home. I went to a screening, and I have to say that the applause at the end was perfunctory. There was no applause during the film at all. I don't know who was there. I don't know who was invited. It must have been some sort of show-busy crowd, given that it was a screening. But I could tell that the audience didn't really take to it. For one thing, the score was terribly eviscerated, it seemed to me. I don't think Drink With Me was 45 seconds long. One Day More, I don't even think it was 2 minutes long, and it didn't have any of the powers it did on stage. This is also one of those properties that makes me feel that sometimes the stage does us a favor in showing us sordid, seamy life and not making it seem so sordid and seamy in the way that movies which deal with reality really do. A lot of this film is really disgusting because people are really dirty. It makes sense. They're in the middle of a revolution, though why they're fighting is never made clear to me. I don't know what the gripe is. And Master of the House is terribly disgusting, too, as you see these people doing things with food that's just quite terrible. It's funny. I'll go off into a tiny tangent here, but, Mark, I want to ask you about a musical that I like very much on disc that I didn't see in London called Betty Blue Eyes. And Betty Blue Eyes is about, after the Second World War, how meat was still being rationed in London and how people had to really hide meat. And it's based on a movie called A Private Function. I couldn't wait to see the movie after hearing the album. And I found the movie so disgusting because people have slabs of meat in bed and they're killing animals. And the same type of thing with Les Mis. I just found it terribly disgusting while they're going through the sewers and all that. I understand the reality of it, but give me the stage where it isn't so nitty gritty, so to speak. I thought everybody in it was perfectly decent, but I think the score sounds thin with that famous business of actually having them sing while they're filming. I felt the orchestra sounded like it was in a completely different country, so that was a problem for me as well.
The orchestra was in a different country because, in fact, they sang to a live.
That's true. Yeah,
it sounds it. You know, I mean, so I don't think it's a disaster. I don't think it's a disgrace. I predict that in Leonard Maltin's book next year, it'll get 2.5 stars out of 4. I mean, that's the type of thing it is. But it's never as exciting to me as it ever was on stage. And for all the talk about this Anne Hathaway getting an Oscar, I have no objection to that, but I don't see that as the slam dunk that so many people do, partly because it isn't even that big a role. God knows, Beatrice Straight won for 9 minutes on screen and network, so I guess it's possible. But she was perfectly decent. I had no problem with the performances. That even goes for Russell Crowe. But wow, where's the excitement that put the chills in my spine back in 1987 when I couldn't wait to see Les Mis to the point to which I had to get in the car and drive to Washington for the tryout, having heard that music. In fact, ironically enough, I remember calling for tickets for the Washington engagement, and I was put on hold for so long, and I didn't care because they were playing the cast album. That's fine, you know, keep me on hold. Needless to say, I was at work. I wasn't paying for the call. So put me on hold. Let me hear this wonderful music out one more time. To me, it was just disappointing. And yes, Mark, I agree with the CGI business. Wow. It looks so CGI to me. So, I don't know if that's something because we're so used to seeing CGI now that we really take it for granted and say, oh, that's CGI. But nevertheless, I find myself having far more respect for movies in the past when I realize they did it the hard way.
We haven't mentioned two assets. But we haven't mentioned a wonderful London stage actress called Samantha Barks, who was discovered via reality TV. She was one of the auditionees for the Oliver casting when they did a revival in the West End, and she's now playing Eponine. So she's a major discovery. Also, we haven't mentioned Eddie Redmayne, who plays Marius, who's also terrific. His last London theatre credit was Richard II at the title role at the Donmar Warehouse, and he's now singing Marius in this film. I've since discovered that he, in fact, although he's never done a musical, stage musical, he was a choral scholar at Cambridge, so he actually can sing. Mm-hmm. They're both worth mentioning because I thought they were both fantastic. And one other thing we haven't mentioned is the new and utterly redundant song they've added to the film, which obviously they always have to add a new song to the film to get an Oscar nomination for Best Song. But it's a song that Valjean sings and is utterly pointless, doesn't add anything to the score at all.
I agree. And because it's not as thrilling as the other songs, it really pales in comparison to them. So I did resent it. So many times they had the song during the Oscar potential nominee at the end of the picture during the credits. It would have been fine with me if they had put that song there, you know, rather than waste the screen time. The movie's 2.5 hours, you know, and after all, the stage show was 3. So as a result, something had to give, and I understand that. But if it were really good, I wouldn't have minded it being 3 hours. But wow, I would have minded what we have here, 3 hours long.
So, still felt too long, even at 2.5, yeah.
It did. You know, the other thing, too, is, wow, the reviews are all over the place, aren't they? I've seen just as many raves as pans, just as many qualified approvals as qualified disapprovals. It really almost seems to be split so evenly, and from what I've read. I don't know if that's been your experience, Mark.
Well, you know, in England, we have so many papers, unlike you here.
Sure,
And I know here there's an awful, nowadays we have so much noise from the internet, so there's an awful lot of opinions flying around anyway. But in London, we have 15 daily papers, 15 papers between the dailies and the Sundays. That means that we have a lot of critics. We actually always, no matter what the show, we get conflicting opinions. Plays go, I mean, look at Betty Blue Eyes, which you cited earlier. It got a 5-star in the Times. Other people, the London Times, that is, other people, like myself, didn't much care for it, in fact. So in other words, in London, there's never a critical consensus in London in the way that there is here in New York.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to point out that, unscientifically at least, my thoughts on the wide range of reviews have been that folks who are musical theater people have been reserved about how happy they are with the film, and people who are not musical theater people have been raving over the top about it. Do you think that that's accurate?
I don't know enough about the people reviewing and their taste, but nevertheless, now that you bring that up, I think I can see that in some of the reviews. I don't know if I can say that.
I sort of feel that way in, you know, if we take it out of the musical theater realm with folks who, the Hobbit, folks who have read the book of The Hobbit go to see the movie and they're like, oh, it's terrible. And people who have not read the book think it's wonderful. And I wonder if it's we have this discussion, we've had it a number of times on here, you know, which is the best cast recording of show X? Well, it's the... you usually like the first one that you bought.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it's
I agree with that entirely.
So
I think it's interesting to see if the film does find an audience, because of course Christmas Day in New York was sold out at the Ziegfeld, but that's all the fans running to see it.
Well,
what's going to happen when it's playing in Minnesota? What's going to happen? Will people really care beyond the musical theater world? And I suspect probably not.
Well, will it find an audience? It found $100 million worth of audience so far. So,
yeah,
So insofar as being a qualified success, usually when you hit the 100 million mark, Hollywood says it's a success. So we'll have to see if...
Indeed, and it hasn't even been released in the UK yet. We don't get it in the UK till January the 11th, so...
It's very strange. Yeah. I can't understand why they do that, but whatever. So we'll see what happens, and we'll see if... I think that we'll be able to tell if the folks behind it feel like it's a success if Cameron is able to make Saigon.
Absolutely.
So we'll see what happens there. One last thing before we move on is this... when we see revivals of shows hit Broadway, and then after they're done on Broadway and they go back out to the regional theaters into licensing, we see lots of adaptations from the revival go into the subsequent performances. Do we think that some of the changes, a la the new song that's been added and some of the cuts that have been made in the film, are going to make their way into licensed official or unofficial versions of Les Miserables in the future when various companies do it after the fact?
I don't think the new song is strong enough to warrant an intervention in the stage production. And also the stage production, as we've already mentioned, is already too long. So short of going into serious overtime, they're not going to actually add that song.
No, but maybe they'll make the cuts that they've made in the film, they'll make them in the stage.
It's interesting, you know, hitherto a big blockbuster show runs and runs and runs in its original production and doesn't get changed beyond the small changes that they make when they transfer it to the West End and then back to or to Broadway, and then those changes get implemented in the other city. But what's interesting with Les Mis is that Cameron has taken quite a bullish approach to renewing it. Last year, when it had its 25th anniversary in the UK, he actually launched a separate new production, the 25th anniversary tour, that in fact toured here as well in the US. And in fact, there was a period of about 2 weeks in London when both productions were playing simultaneously. One was playing at the Barbican and one was playing at the West End. Interestingly, in the film credits for Les Miserables, John Caird and Trevor Nunn, who get very, very minimal credit, they just get listed alongside the office assistants of Cameron Mackintosh's London office. There's an additional credit immediately below theirs. It's for the revival, the 25th anniversary revival production, directed by James Connor, Lawrence Connor, we've forgotten the other guy's name, James somebody, who were in fact assistants to Trevor and John on a previous production, on the original production. Cameron does want to give a new version of the show. It's interesting to see what he does with Miss Saigon. I think he's going to give it to Lawrence Connor again. Lawrence Connor is currently the flavor of the month. I think the productions are no longer set in stone. You no longer just have to, a la Jerome Robbins, do the same version every single time.
Mark, have you seen Les Mis since it transferred from, it was the Palace, right, to the Queen's? The Queen's is a small theater. How does it play in there?
Smaller theater, but actually they made it fit. Initially, and it's really interesting what they did to that. Initially, when they moved it from the Palace to the Queen's, they cited the fact that there was a small orchestra pit to abandon the big orchestra, and they reduced the orchestra by about eight instruments, and introduced the dreaded sinfonia, which is augmented orchestration electronically. What Cameron's done there since is interesting, is that he's actually brought the orchestra back up to the full size. They've done some reconstruction work at the Queen's, and he's brought up a bigger. It does need a full orchestra, that music. But I have seen it fairly recently. I saw it with Alfie Bowe, who's a brilliant English opera singer. Actually, he came to Broadway in La Boheme, the Baz Luhrmann.
Sure.
Played Valjean, and he was quite extraordinary. And then more recently, I've seen it in the West End with Ramin Karimloo, who of course played the original Phantom in Love Never Dies. Mm-hmm. And he was also wonderful. So the show is in very good shape in London.
On my own, pretending he's beside me, all alone, I walk with him till morning. Without him, I feel his arms around me. I lose my way, I close my eyes, and he has found me in the rain.
Peter had brought up Betty Blue Eyes. Forgive me, Mark, did you mention Betty Blue Eyes? Did you see that?
I did see it, and I wasn't a huge fan. I mean, I'm a huge fan of George Stiles and Anthony Drew, the composing team behind it. And if you listened to the album, as Peter did only, I'm sure you'd think it's a complete delight, because the album is delightful and there is some great music in it. On stage, it's meant to be it's a light, effortless piece. It was heavy-handed, and it all seemed to revolve around this annoying animatronic pig, who's the star character in it, and voiced, by the way, briefly by Kylie Minogue. The pig virtually speaks briefly. But it's all much ado about nothing. I mean, really, it's a nearly 3-hour musical about a pig, whether or not it gets slaughtered. It was just too much to take. And of course, in the film, you had the brilliant, brilliant Maggie Smith, who and Michael Palin, who made it quite wonderful. So I thought this was a film, a stage adaptation too far.
By the way, if anybody wants to see Betty Blue Eyes, they will be able to do so this summer at Music Theater of Wichita. It's going to make its American premiere there, and I know I'm going to be in the audience seeing it, so I have that to look forward to. Again, Mark, I may come to the exact same conclusion you came to, but so many of the songs in Betty Blue Eyes truly intoxicate me, so as a result, I am looking forward to it.
So let's move on to our next topic. Mark got a chance to see Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. We've talked about it here before, but I'm interested to get Mark's perspective on this. So Mark, why don't you tell us what you thought about it?
This is a play I've seen. I mean, it's one of the standard classics of the American theater, and we see it in London every few years, just as you see it on Broadway every few years. So I've seen it numerous times. But what was really striking for me, seeing it again just yesterday at the Booth Theater, with actors that, of course, I know who Tracy Letts is and Amy Morton, because I've seen August of Osage County came to the West End, to the National Theater, with Amy Morton reprising her performance. Neither of them are star names. In a Broadway that is saturated with stars, the only way you can get a play to Broadway is by putting a star in it, it seems. It's rather lovely, or rather wonderful, that actually here it just proves that you don't need stars to make a show. You just need to have a good play, beautifully directed. This is actually one of the finest productions I think I've ever seen of the play, because it excavates to a dark territory that most people are too scared to go to. And yet, it also retains the play's overwhelming compassion. I mean, this couple, you know, not unlike Amanda and Elliot's lives. They're bound together forever by hatred as much as love. But there is something underneath it that this couple are going to survive, unlike the other couple. And I thought that was really striking in this production, is that you just feel that the younger couple, there's no chance they're going to survive. They're doomed. And again, two actors I'd never have seen before, two Chicago actors, quite wonderful. A really, really beautiful production.
That's great.
But it's not selling. And of course, Mark gave the reason why, that there are no stars in this production, not that the average theater goer knows. And it's really hurt the production terribly, because this is a property that's always been associated with stars. Granted, Broadway stars when it first started, Uta Hagen, Arthur Hill, but once that movie happened with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, who were the stars of the moment, and all the revivals we've had, you know, be it Colleen Dewhurst, be it Kathleen Turner, I mean, there have been people that you have heard of, and I'm afraid that Mark is absolutely right when he says that having no stars has really been a liability for this production.
But then you have shows with stars like Paul Rudd in Grace or The Dreadful Dead Accounts with Katie Holmes, and those are just bad shows, so they don't sell either.
No, that's true. I guess the answer is you got to have stars in a good show. I mean, I guess that's not really big news, but nevertheless, you can't have one without the other. Actually, you can. We've had many exceptions over the years, but you're right. I mean, the public has not responded to Grace, even with Paul Rudd in it, and certainly not with Katie Holmes. Dead Accounts really did no business whatsoever, and it's not surprising, given the lack of business it's doing, that it's giving up the ghost. You got to see it while you were here?
I did, I'm afraid.
Yes. Uh-huh. Not a feature.
Like you, I just have to collect these things. I mean,
sure. Oh, please. I understand.
I have to collect a bad flop.
Mark, tell us about the West End. Do you have star casting there? What's the situation there?
London is as star-driven, I think, as Broadway is. But we actually, I think we get the balance better between putting stars in and putting them in the right vehicles. But if I give you the roll call of just some of the actors we're getting in London this coming year, 2013, we're going to get, and this, by the way, this is just one company, Michael Grandage, who, of course, made the Donmar Warehouse into the most important theatre in London when he ran it and is now running a West End company. He alone has got employing Judi Dench, Daniel Radcliffe, Sheridan Smith, Jude Law, and David Walliams. And in the current season, at the moment, he's got Simon Russell Beale in Private on Parade. But we've also got, this coming season, Helen Mirren, James McAvoy, Rowan Atkinson, Kristen Scott Thomas, Rufus Sewell, Zoe Wanamaker, Anthony Scher, Rupert Everett, Kim Cattrall, Lee Evans, Fiona Shaw, and many others. I mean, so we still do the star thing in London, absolutely.
How many of them are going to be in classic works?
Many of them, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would expect that.
So several of those, the two of those Michael Grandage plays are Shakespeare. One is the one that Daniel Radcliffe is doing is a Martin McDonagh play, The Cripple of Inishman. But by no means all. I mean, Lee Evans and Sheila Hancock are doing a new play in the West End. Kristen Scott Thomas and Rufus Sewell are doing Pinter's Old Times. So we have a very mixed diet in the West End. What we get fewer of in the West End, as opposed to Broadway, we don't get very many new plays opening cold on in the West End. The West End plays almost always are revivals nowadays or classic plays. The age of the new play in the West End, like Dead Accounts is on Broadway, that's dead. We don't get new plays in the West End.
That's pretty fascinating. There was a lot of controversy this week because it was announced that Kenny Leon was going to do a production of A Raisin in the Sun with Denzel Washington. And people saying, well, what a shame that he's not doing a new play. This comes up quite a bit when stars decide to tackle roles on Broadway, but they more often than not seem to be in revivals rather than taking a chance on a new play. So that's pretty much the case in London too.
Exactly. Well, the thing is, the stars in London, they do new plays, but they do them in protected environments like the Donmar Warehouse or the Oneida or the National, particularly the National, where the stakes are not quite as high. Of course, the salaries aren't quite as high either. So the theatres are protected too. In order to lure a star to do a West End or a Broadway play, you have to pay them serious money. To do a new play at the National, they're being paid $1,000 a week, if that. So, you know, they take a chance too, but they're in a protected place.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that because I'm about to embark on a new book in which I'm going to compare the 1963-1964 Broadway season, which was the first one I really paid attention to on a daily basis, and comparing it with whatever the 2013-2014 season will be 50 years later. And certainly it's going to be hard to match the stars that happened in 63-64. I mean, six Oscar winners, Claudette Colbert, Jose Ferrer, Alec Guinness, Helen Hayes, Van Heflin, Joanne Woodward. But in addition to that, Charles Boyer, Kirk Douglas, Albert Finney, Hermina Gingold, Farley Granger, Tab Hunter, Angela Lansbury, Paul Newman, Lee Remick, French O'Tone, Tallulah Bankhead, Tom Bosley, Hume Cronin, Colleen Dewhurst, Alfred Drake, Demi Grimes, Hal Holbrook, Mary Martin, Christopher Plummer, Robert Preston, Julie Harris, Cyril Richard, Jason Robards Jr., Carol Channing, Robert Redford, and oh yes, Barbara Streisand. So I mean, this was quite a season. And most of them, however, most of them were in new shows. And what it really comes down to is that most of them signed run of the play contracts, and that's the difference with today, where people who are big Hollywood stars say, "Give me a limited engagement so I can get my Tony and go back to Hollywood and make money again."
Peter, please tell me that you didn't do that from memory. You have a list there in front.
Yes, that's my proposal. I'm looking at. Of course, I didn't do it from memory.
Peter, you need to add Barbara Cook. Barbara Cook, She Loves Me, 1963.
Yeah, that was the 62-63 season, though. So that's why I can't do that. I'm really going to concentrate on who opened. She Loves Me opened April 23rd, 1963. So it's for Tony purposes. Yes, it was in the 63-64 Tonys, but not in the actual season. So we had to wait another year to see Barbara Cook in 64-65, who was in a musical called Something More, which never got officially recorded, I'm sorry to say. It would have been fun to have another Broadway cast album with Barbara Cook, given that we didn't have that many to begin with.
Peter, you know, that list there, it makes me think that season was like a golden age of Broadway.
Sure. I mean, and of course, that year, people were saying, oh, what a terrible season. You know, I mean, the way they all do, you know. So William Goldman, when he wrote the book The Season, talked about how what a terrible season it was. He said, but I dare say that in years to come we'll look back and say, wow, you know, look what was here. I mean, yeah, these were good plays, these were good people, you know. So, and he's right.
Mind you, I think we're probably living in a golden age now compared to the year that Starmites opened on Broadway in the 80s.
Well, all this talk about the Golden Age, we have Manhattan Theater Club has a production of Golden Age, and Peter and Mark have seen it. So, Peter, why don't you tell us about it?
Well, this is a Terrence McNally play, and if anybody knows anything about Terrence McNally, he certainly loves opera. It came up in Lisbon Traviata many years ago. It came up, too, in a masterclass, and now I guess this is the third jewel of the Triple Crown with The Golden Age, which deals with the opening night of Vincenzo Bellini, I Puritani, The Puritans, concentrate on that. By the way, I even heard a recycled line from Lisbon Traviata because there's talk of Maria Callas not being flat. She was occasionally sharp, but never flat. And that line is actually recycled, dealing with somebody else here. So this is backstage on opening night in 1835. And you see the various people who are certainly backstage. The soprano, Julia Grisi, the baritone, Antonio Tamburini, the tenor, Giovanni Battista Rubini, the bass, Luigi LeBlanc. But of course, if you're going to have anything involving opera, you're going to have divas, and you get two of them here. One of them is Maria Malibran, who's played by B.B. Newirth, who certainly has the ability to play a diva. It's something that comes with her territory. She knows how to do that, to say the least. So she does battle with the woman who has actually been engaged to be in this opera. So it's all these backstage shenanigans, and I'm not going on. Yes, I am going on. You're going to have to go on. All that type of stuff. It's exactly what you'd expect under the circumstances. And I found it certainly watchable, certainly entertaining on a basic level, but never gripping. Not at least until Rossini comes in at the end, because Rossini is the eminence grise of opera at this point. And so that's a nice scene. George Moorfogan is the actor I saw do it, I thought he was fine. So not as impressive as the other two plays, and I'm sorry to say that, because it would have been really great to have the third jewel of the Triple Crown really be a diamond, but I don't think it's quite in that category, and I don't think it has that many carrots involved.
I thought it was just dire, I'm afraid. I thought it was a terrible play about making great art, and I thought that McNally was turning gold into base metal. I thought it was unredeemingly terrible, and I thought that the actor playing Rossini at the end was ghastly. They had nothing to work with. McNally gave them nothing. It was a really grim afternoon. At one point, a character says sometimes there's nothing to say, and I wish the playwright had heeded that advice.
All righty. So that's the Golden Age at Manhattan Theater Club. We have 13 things about Ed Carpaletti at 59 East 59, which actually just closed yesterday. But Peter and Mark saw it. So, Mark, why don't you start us off with it?
Actually closes today.
Today's the 30th. The 30th. Yes, it closes today. I was thinking because I'm thinking about tomorrow.
Indeed. Well, first of all, I should declare an interest, which is that Barry Kleinbord, who wrote the book, music, lyrics, and directed it, is a friend. But sometimes when you see a show that a friend has worked on, it's quite hard to talk about, because especially if you don't like it. But in this case, it's actually a really terrific piece. A very small piece. It's only a one woman cabaret piece. It provides Penny Fuller, who's quite wonderful, I think, a really beautiful vehicle to summons a whole world of loss, loss as a widow, facing actually destitution because her husband has left her with a trail of debt, and actually resolves it in a very sweet and beautiful way. I was really touched and moved by this piece.
Peter, what did you think about it?
Well, for one thing, we have a golden age here with Penny Fuller playing it because she opened almost 50 years to the day from her first Broadway role. And so there was something very nice about that happening, that she had been in a play called The Moon Besieged, in which she originated the role of wedding guest. So it's really nice to look back and see that Penny Fuller is still here and doing wonderful work. I have been told by many people her performance in Applause as Eve Harrington is one of the best they've ever seen, and I mean that, one of the best they've ever seen. I did not see it because I saw Applause in Baltimore when Diane McAfee was playing the role. Penny Fuller succeeded her. So it really was something to see Penny do this part. And yes, it is about a woman who finds that her husband did leave her with a lot of money owed, and how difficult that's going to be, because after all, we are not talking about the strata of society here that works out some easy terms. We're talking about people who are veritable gangsters. So this play, this musical, by the way, has its basis in a play, Jeffrey Hatcher's Three Viewings. I don't know if you saw that in 1995, but that was one where three people had monologues while they were in funeral homes musing about the person who had died. And so Barry Kleinbord, a very talented composer-lyricist, did an adaptation for her. Specifically, he wrote it for her because she did the part when it was done at Manhattan Theater Club on the same stage where Golden Age is now. And I have to say the thing I don't like about it is the title. I think it's a cumbersome title, I think it should simply be called 13 Things and leave it at that. But it is very moving to see this woman cope. What's also interesting is the subtext that her parents didn't want her to marry him in the first place. So the subtext here is, you know, maybe you should listen to your parents before you get married to somebody. Maybe your parents are smarter. And they're right. But Barry has a wonderful imagination, and one of the best things he's done, there was just a passing reference in the original play about going to see a Martin Lewis film, My Friend Irma, and he has made this into a song that is really quite the tour de force, in which she gets to portray different characters and repeat lines and all that kind of thing. So I think that's really great. And the song at the end may be one of the most beautiful songs we've heard this season. So it really is something, and I hope that there's going to be much more of a life for this show with a different title, chopped off title. I hope Penny gets to do it again so that she can get an award or two rather than being in this cabaret setting. It's at 59 East 59th, but it's you sit at tables. I also think that this show would be a very good one for additional productions in regional theater and community theater, because there are going to be actresses of, as they say, a certain age who are looking for properties that they can really sink their teeth into. And here's a one-woman show, you know, and it's really quite a potent one. So I wish it all the luck in the world.
Thank you, Peter, for that. And Mark, I can appreciate exactly what you're saying. It's very hard for us to talk about shows when we are personally involved with the creators of them, and it's especially hard when the show is tough. Mm-hmm. So we're happy.
I always say though that if our opinions are meant to count for anything, you have to be absolutely honest.
And, oh, absolutely.
And of course, creative people always want good reviews, and it's lovely to be able to give them. But if you can't give them, you mustn't, because give good reviews. That is, because you have to be honest. And if it counts, if it loses a friendship, it loses a friendship. Our job is not to be friends with creative people. Our job is to report honestly to the public.
Yeah, I've lost friendships over opinions. There's no question about it. I remember one time a young writer asked me to come to his musical, and afterwards I told him what was wrong. And I wasn't cruel about it, really. It's just that he wanted raves, and it really caused a real rift. You know, you're not being supportive. Well, you know, I'd be a liar and no friend at all just to say, oh, darling, you were wonderful. I mean, it just doesn't help. I would really think that people, especially since this was a reading, it's not like, you know, so there's time to work on it and all that goes with that. So, and I know it's hard. We all want to hear raves about our stuff. I mean, we want to hear raves about what we do. Of course we do. You know, I understand it, but it's impossible to be in this business for any length of time without making enemies and because of opinions. It's just impossible.
Well, yeah. I have to say that back in my performing days, my toughest critic was my mother.
You know, I've heard a lot of things like that. I know an actor who says his son is merciless towards him whenever he performs. So, you know, if you don't get support from the relatives, why should you expect it from us? You know, so,
well, let's move forward and take this opportunity with Mark with us to. I'm going to put you on the spot here, Mark. I didn't ask you to prep this. Can you, off the top of your head, extemporaneously let us know, you know, kind of give us a 2012 wrap up of the West End, the major players there, and what was really good that you liked, that if anybody's jumping on a plane, they should go see, or is things that we've perhaps missed?
Absolutely. Well, it was quite a tough year in London because, of course, we had the Olympics, which put on a show in itself, right. And actually did one pretty good service, which was that it saw off Chicago in the West End. The trouble with these with very long running shows is that they take up important real estate, the theaters get locked into these shows forever and a day, literally nowadays. And actually, thanks to the Olympics, we lost both Chicago and Blood Brothers. Now both of those are great shows, but it's no bad thing that you know they've gone and made room for something else. Actually, the Olympics themselves, of course, were the two big. What was the biggest show of the year? Both the opening ceremony of the Olympics and then the opening ceremony of the Paralympics a few weeks later. Of course, those were one-off shows, but they were viewed by audiences, unparalleled by any theatre show. And of course, the budgets exceeded even that of Spider-Man: Turn Off the Dark. And the budgets for those two shows, the Paralympics opening and closing ceremony and the Olympics closing opening and closing ceremonies, was put at £81 million, about $140 million. So that's quite an extraordinary budget for a one-off ceremony or series of one-off ceremonies. But beyond the Olympics, we had some amazing shows in London, and of course the National Theatre, as always, led the way. I feel it's obviously the you know, we are so lucky and blessed to have the National Theatre. The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which is a stage version of a novel by Mark Haddon, was one of the best plays of the year, and that's actually transferring to the West End in March, coming to the Apollo Theatre. All about it's difficult to describe it because he's he may or may not be autistic. He's not in the book. He's not described as autistic. He's described as having behavioural problems. A 15-year-old boy with behavioural problems who solves the death of a dog in his yard, which he's falsely accused of murdering. It's a really spellbinding piece of theatre. That was one of the best plays of the year. Another one that's still running at the National. Another two that are still running. Lucy Prebble's The Effect is a play all about clinical drugs trials and how they can go wrong. but also how the two participants in one fall in love, directed by Rupert Gould, who's one of our best theatre directors, and also James Graham's This House, again at the National. All of these plays, by the way, all in the smallest Cottesloe Theatre, but This House is moving to the Olivier in next month, is a play set in the House of Commons. Quite wonderful. Again, at the National, Alan Bennett's new play, People, starring Francis Tour, who came to New York with the History Boys, is another wonderful play by Alan Bennett. A couple of shows at the National that you can't see anymore. Simon Russell Beale was in an amazing production of Timon of Athens. Simon Russell Beale is now in the West End in Privates on Parade, which launches the Michael Grandage Company, and Simon Russell Beale is the greatest actor in London now, and you never want to miss anything he does. The other one that came to that's not no longer at the National is a new play called The Last of the Housemans. It starred Rory Kinnear and Julie Walters, and that was also really spellbindingly brilliant. Beyond the National, we also, of course, have the Royal Court, and the Royal Court had an amazing year as well. They did a West End season at the Duke of York's with the transfer of Nick Payne's Constellations. Nick Payne, of course, who recently had a play off-Broadway here with Jake Gyllenhaal, and Constellations was another of the plays of the year. The Royal Court also had a new play by Carol Churchill that was extraordinary, called Love and Information, and another new play by Jez Butterworth, who wrote Jerusalem, this time called The River, starring Dominic West, who's best known from The Wire. A series of extraordinary plays. I mean, the ability of the National and the RS and the Royal Court in particular to find these and develop these brand new plays is quite wonderful. Dominic West, by the way, and I can't wait to see this. I'm going home next week to see Dominic West play Professor Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady at the Sheffield Crucible. It's the first musical he's done, so I'm really looking forward to seeing that. Directed by Daniel Evans, who, of course, did Sunday in the Park with George Broadway. Michael Grandage has, as I mentioned, launched his own West End company. That's going to change the West End forever. If anybody's heading to London, there's one musical to see and one musical to avoid. The adaptation of Whitney Houston's The Bodyguard is actually really good, surprisingly good, and stars Heather Headley, who's an extraordinary presence in the Whitney Houston role. And then, of course, there's also the dreaded new Spice Girls musical, Viva Forever, which is a complete disaster. After Mamma Mia, which is the same producer, Judy Kramer, unfortunately, Viva Forever just hits a rock bottom, really, in terms of those jukebox musicals.
Is it selling, Mark?
In London, we never know, because unless you physically turn up at the theatre and inspect the house, as it were, count the house, mm-hmm. you won't know, because we don't publish figures. What's interesting is that they opened to a declared £4 million advance. Mm-hmm. I worked out that at an average ticket price of £50, and of course West End ticket prices are ever rising, so actually... Sure. Higher average than £50. That will take them last them about 4 months. Unless the advance grows, I suspect it won't be around for too long. Mm-hmm. There is a wonderful triumphant revival of Merrily We Roll Along at the Menier Chocolate Factory. The Menier Chocolate Factory has become London, has become sometimes de facto London home. They transferred Little Night Music and Sunday in the Park with George both to the West End and Broadway. Strongly suspect that Merrily We Roll Along will move certainly to the West End, but I suspect possibly also to Broadway. It's time to bring it back to Broadway. There's a good reason why it might move, which is that Maria Friedman is the director of it. Maria Friedman making her directorial debut, and she does a fantastic job of directing this. She is the sister of Sonia Friedman, who is one of our leading commercial producers. I'm sure it'll be Sonia's mission to bring this to Broadway. So
how wonderful.
That's great. Amazing that you were able to do that without preparation. Thank you so much. All right, let's move into the news section of our show. It is the last show of 2012, so We do have a lot of recaps as we just had there, but Peter had a special recap in Masterworks Broadway this week, a remembrance column. Peter, do you want to mention this a little bit? We'll link to it so people can read the full column.
Well, yeah, it was a year in which we lost a lot of people. Of course, it always is. There's no way around that. That's always going to happen. So it's time to certainly remember the ones that we lost, even people who we haven't seen for a while or even just saw once. For example, Patricia Nui, who died at 92, a nice ripe old age, who, after all, introduced Climb Every Mountain in Sound of Music. She was the Mother Abbess. So she died this year, I'm sorry to say. Richard Adler, whose career might have been very different if his partner Jerry Ross hadn't died so many years ago, because they're the only two people to have two consecutive Best Musical Tony winners, and The Pajama Game and Damn Yankees, and they did them in 357 days, not even a year apart, those shows opened. And then Jerry Ross died, and it was never the same for Richard Adler. They had a chemistry that was amazing. Hal David died. He only gave us one Broadway show, Promises, Promises, but he did a really good job with the lyrics on that one. And, you know, when times were tough in Boston, they said, we need a new song here. He came up with I'll Never Fall in Love Again. So that's pretty impressive. Jack Klugman died too at 90. A lovely man. I enjoyed interviewing him so much. He was exactly the type of interviewer's dream, who would not only tell you stories, but then say, you want to know the person who I like best? You know, that he would offer things and make it so much easier. All you had to do was turn on the tape recorder and you knew you were all set. And it wasn't a case of, you should pardon the expression, an old man who had to talk. No, he was doing you the favor. He knew what you needed, and I'll never forget that at all. I learned the other day, by the way, that I had once known this and I had forgotten it. He was the original director. He was signed to direct the musical The Fig Leaves Are Falling in 1969, and decided at the last minute not to do it, and George Abbott took over. But that's kind of interesting, because we're getting a production of The Fig Leaves Are Falling, granted heavily revised, but starting in a couple of weeks at the Connolly downtown. So Theodore Mann died, a wonderful producer, the guy who really jump-started the interest in Eugene O'Neill when he was out of favor back in the 50s with a production of The Iceman Cometh that was so good that O'Neill's widow, Carlotta, said Gene didn't want Long Day's Journey Into Night to be produced until 25 years after his death, but you guys did such a good job, Paul Libin, the other one, and Jose Quintero, that I want to give you the rights, so put it on Broadway. And that's really something. So we lost him too, Yeah, saddest to me was Living Marvin Hamlisch, another guy who'd always been lovely to me, and a guy who I thought was terribly underrated. You know, when you have a big hit like Chorus Line, it's very hard to trump that. And it's one of the reasons why the lyricist Ed Klaban, as we know from the musical Class Act, never did anything else. He found it too daunting. Marvin Hamlisch did try. And while he did have a hit with his next show, They're Playing Our Song, after that it was pretty dire. And I think there's wonderful work, wonderful songs in Smile, The Goodbye Girl, and Sweet Smell of Success. And I'm sorry that it didn't work out better for him with those three shows, because I thought there was a lot of merit in those shows. So those were some of the people we lost, I'm sorry to say. But I'm very glad that most of them at least lived long and, for the most part, healthy lives.
Mark, had you seen Jack Klugman on stage?
Yes, indeed, I had. He actually came to London and did a play at the Haymarket. It was a Neil Simon. I think it was The Odd Couple, I think. I couldn't swear to that, but he came to London to do a comedy. By then, of course, he'd already lost his voice. You know, he was using their processed voice box thing, which was slightly unnerving to watch an actor through. But, you know, it was kind of amazing. He was amazing. You know, his television legacy will live on. Peter mentioned Marvin Hamlisch there. We've just had a wonderful revival, a British premiere of Marvin Hamlisch's Sweet Smell of Success on the London Fringe. It showed that was actually a much better show than I seem to remember it from the Broadway production. So yes, that's a keen loss. Absolutely. I mean, of course, you know, life has to end, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. What's great about artists' work is that they will never die. Hamlish's chorus line is being revived in the West End this coming year at the London Palladium. So, you know, his work will live on forever.
All right. And we also had a loss of Charles Durning. Peter, did you mention Charles Durning in your piece?
No. It hadn't happened yet, actually. But he was very nice to me, too, when he was doing Glengarry Glen Ross down at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton. And, you know, there's a nice lesson to be learned here about the resilience of actors, both with Jack Klugman, who, as Mark pointed out, did have a voice problem. He did have cancer, and you would think that he would shy away and that's it. He wouldn't want to work anymore, but he wanted to work. Charles Durning's story isn't as dire, but nevertheless, he was in the original company of Fiddler on the Roof and was written out. And it must have been very discouraging for an actor to be written out of something that turned out to be, at that time, the longest running show in the history of Broadway. That could really discourage somebody. And it did take 8 years before he really had his breakout role after that, when he was in that championship season. So it's pretty impressive that he didn't get discouraged and say, I'm going to go into the shoe business. I've had enough. It's too hard. The answer always is to keep going forward. And Charles Durning knew that, and certainly had a terrific career that started in midlife thanks to that championship season.
All right, moving forward, we have touched upon the news that Dead Accounts is going to be closing on January 6th. We have two other shows that are closing today. Christmas Story and Bring It On are closing. Mark, did you get a chance to see A Christmas Story?
I did. And I was charmed by it to a point. I did think, well, it's slightly unnerving to, you know, 2 weeks seeing it 2 weeks after Newport to see a musical that celebrates a young man, a 10-year-old boy.
I know, yeah.
Treasured sure. Christmas is a gun. I feel slightly queasy, frankly. That's a subject for a musical. Having said that, I think the two young songwriters who've written it, who are not yet 30, were not born when the film originally premiered, are really talented. They've done some great work in it. And Caroline O'Connor, who's an Australian.
Very.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I saw her play Mama Rose at Leicester Market earlier this year. Is a real triumph. I mean, they always say don't work with children or animals. In fact, this show has children and animals. I think should be told not to work with Caroline O'Connor because she stole the show.
That's a good point about the guns. I hadn't thought about that, and I wonder if it's affected some of their box office there. The way
it hasn't affected their box office, but I imagine the mood is not quite what it was before that terrible, terrible incident. Similarly speaking, I was down in Cape May, New Jersey, to see A Tuna Christmas, which is about this mythical town of Tuna, Texas. And of course, you know, there's a bit about guns in there. And frankly, given that Tuna Christmas is really a glorified review more than the play, because it really is vignettes, I'm amazed they didn't drop the sequence about the gun store and go get your guns and all that kind of business. It's just too painful, considering the circumstances. So I'm very glad I saw Christmas Story before the tragedy. Of course, I wish, of course, as the rest of us, that there were no tragedy to begin with. But nevertheless, it must cast a pall. And I'm not surprised to hear you react the way that you did, Mark, because how else could we react under these circumstances?
It's very striking, isn't it? I mean, two other shows I've seen this week. Grace, of course, ends in a, or actually begins with a terrible shootout. The play. It's not a spoiler because the play recaps to how that shootout happens. Of course, in Virginia Woolf, there's a moment when and pretends to shoot Martha. In fact, it's a toy gun and it shoots an umbrella out. But that is a spoiler. But clearly, you know, suddenly you start noticing guns everywhere on Broadway.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, this is such a part of the fabric of the society, and it does start to give you pause.
Yes.
Mark, did you get a chance to see Bring It On any time during your visits in the last couple of months?
Actually, I saw it when it first opened in the summer, and I was absolutely charmed by it. I thought it was a delight, really, really talented writing. Of course, you know, Lin-Manuel writes really fantastic songs, but I just thought that the spectacle of it was great, and I'm really, really surprised it hasn't become a huge hit. I'm surprised that it's closing today. I thought it was a show that was going to run and run and run.
Do you think it'll transfer?
I agree. I expected it to be far more successful than it was. I think it's the book by Jeff Witte, especially, is very, very pungent and brings up a lot of good points about friendship and loyalty. And so I'm very surprised it didn't do better than it did.
Transfer. I mean, it's an all-American subject. It's hugely unlikely to transfer. Having said that, High School Musical 1 and 2 have both been huge hits in the UK, so you never know. But I think this is too uniquely American. We don't have a cheerleader culture.
What do we think the issue was with Bring It On?
I just wonder if people have been High School Musical'd out and figured it was the same thing all over again. That's the best I can do for a theory, but... otherwise I'm mystified because I really got involved with the characters. I really cared about them and I didn't expect to when I walked into that theater. So that was one of its great strengths. I consider the book of that musical really the best book that I've seen this season so far. I won't mind if it's eclipsed by another one, but nevertheless, I think it's quality work. I'm hoping that and expect, by the way, that it will get done quite a bit in high schools around the country. And it'll be nice because drama clubs can work with cheerleading squads, and each of them can come away with an appreciation for the great work that each does.
All right, so let's end this morning on a we touched upon it briefly, but it looks as though that Denzel Washington is coming back to Broadway, and it's kind of wraps up all the things that we've talked about today: stars and shows and revivals and no new works and a possibility of Raisin in the Sun with Denzel Washington. What do we think about this?
Well, it's striking to me that Broadway seems to recycle its past even quicker than ever before.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. On the other hand, to be fair, tickets are so expensive now that there must be a substantial portion of the population who wanted to go see Raisin in the Sun 8 years ago and didn't have the money. Well, now they're going to have a chance to see it. Given that these shows are limited engagements and they only have about 1,000 seats a week, a day capacity, there are people who don't get to see them. But it is true for those of us who go all the time, it seems like the day before yesterday that Raisin in the Sun was on Broadway.
And even more so Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which is now previewing. I mean, that comes around every 5 years at the moment.
Yeah, but as I say, limited engagements, and a lot of I guarantee you, most of the public missed it. I guess they're getting more chances than they used to. In the old days, plays used to open, run for a year, hit plays ran for a year and a half, and people got the chance to see it. Now it seems like they're running a year and a half, but in these strange increments of limited engagements, and then coming back in no time at all.
All right, so I'm going to wrap it up here, but one little thing that I wanted to mention, I saw that the league had started to promote Kids Night on Broadway, and I wanted to share a little story with you guys. I have a 9-year-old son, and he asked for Christmas, he really wanted Jets tickets. Mm-hmm. Our local football team here, American football. Mm-hmm. And I was going to go get them. I could not touch a jet ticket for less than $250 a seat.
Wow. And they stink this year, by the way.
Yeah. And so I was, I'll get four tickets for me and Justin and my wife and Charlotte. And it's $1,000 and plus the driving and everything. And I just want to raise again that when people say Broadway is too expensive, but you cannot, Jets and Giants and Rangers and Islanders and all the sports teams around here, Yankees are more expensive than Broadway. And harder to get, and much more limited. Certainly, they don't play eight times a week. And Kids Night on Broadway is coming around where you can buy a full-price adult ticket and get a children's ticket for free. So I'm going to put the link for Kids Night on Broadway, which is coming up in, I think it's February or March. I should have had that in front of me, but I don't. Let me see what they have here. Kids Night on Broadway is February 25th to March 3rd. Tickets go on sale January 9th, and I'll have a link to the Kids Night on Broadway website there, and you can see which shows are participating. A lot of great shows. You can see Lion King and Mary Poppins and Cinderella and all sorts of other stuff. So, you know, you can have a great night out for less expensive than going to a sporting event, although.
And you don't have to sit in the cold.
Oh, even better. Even cold, snow, winding, blurry.
Right.
Oh, horrendous.
Cold should be the least of it, you know.
I mean, absolutely.
Right, it could snow, absolutely. So,
All right, so I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe link there. That way, each and every time a new episode of This Week on Broadway comes out, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If, in fact, you want to listen to us in other ways, you can get us through the Stitcher app, which is an application for your BlackBerry, your Android device, your iPhone, and stream us there, or listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you would like links to all the things that we've talked about today, go to BroadwayRadio.com and we'll have links and videos and all sorts of other stuff. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, for me, for Mark, all there in one spot. Call us, leave us your opinions on anything that we talked about, especially Les Miserables, because it's interesting to hear what everybody's got to say about this and we can actually all see it at the same time. And so take it from there. So on behalf of Mark Shenton, thank you so much for joining us. And Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
But remember this, my brother. Seeing this some higher plan, you must use this precious silver to become an honest man. By the witness of the martyrs, by the passion and the blood, God has raised you out of darkness. I have saved your soul for you.